We move on to the sixth case, which is United States versus Franklin. Mr. Pigeon.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Ray Pigeon, and I represent the defendant in this case, Cedric Franklin. Cedric Franklin was indicted for making false statements on applications to purchase firearms. The case did not proceed to trial. He entered a plea of guilty. However, before that, there was a motion to suppress his statement. Actually, it was a confession, and the judge denied that. That issue was preserved by agreement of the parties, and that is the reason that the case is here at this juncture. Judge Holderman decided that the defendant was not in a custodial situation and therefore he was not entitled to Miranda warnings. Moreover, Judge Holderman found that there were not psychological means that were used to obtain a statement or confession from the defendant, Mr. Franklin. The facts of the case are relatively short. There was a gun that was found as a result of a traffic stop. The gun was examined. It was thrown, and the person who had the gun fled the scene. The gun was examined, sent to a laboratory. They found the serial number was able to be restored. It had been obliterated to a certain extent, and that led the FBI agents to, excuse me, federal agents, excuse me, to the home.
ATF, you want to grab that one?
Pardon, Judge?
ATF agent.
Yeah, it is ATF. I have too many DEA, FBI.
And there are a lot of numbers, a lot of letters in the alphabet to keep me mixed up with government.
I apologize to the court. Any event, it led the agents to the home of Cedric Franklin. There were at least two tobacco firearm agents who went there. It was also another police officer with the gang crimes unit, Chicago police officer. They went to Franklin's home. However, the beginning of the approach to his home, I think, reveals something about perhaps what their intention was, their objectives, when they went to Mr. Franklin's home. They parked, although there was a parking lot right in front of a driveway right in front of Mr. Franklin's home and ample space to park there, they parked approximately a half a block away. When they got to Mr. Franklin's home...
They're going to furtively sneak up on him, but you weren't here for the furtive part. Go ahead.
Pardon, Judge?
I say they were furtively sneaking up on him, but you have to get a definition of what is a furtive.
Yeah. And when they arrived, they were allowed into the house by Mrs. Franklin. Mr. Franklin, however, was in his bathrobe and his house slippers at the time.
And concerned about a domestic violent case.
Exactly. He thought that they were there for that reason. They did explain to him that they were there regarding some recovered property, but they didn't explain to Mr. Franklin at that time that they were there to question him about his purchase of weapons. The three agents took Mr. Franklin into a kitchen. I think I can fairly describe it as being a small kitchen, which is off of the hallway area. The three agents stayed with Mr. Franklin in the kitchen for approximately 2 hours. Almost at all times, there was one agent on either side of Mr. Franklin, and there was who was sitting down at the time, and so were the two agents. Immediately behind him was a Chicago police officer, a lady officer, who stood there for the entire 2 hours within approximately a couple of feet behind him. After Mr. Franklin, the questioning began, the agents bluntly told Mr. Franklin that we don't think you're telling us the truth. Mrs. Franklin was in the room at the time, and then he turned to Mrs. Franklin, and they asked her whether she thought the defendant was telling the truth or not. After that, it is rather apparent from the testimony that was brought forth during the course of the hearing that
he never asked them to leave, did he?
He did not ask them to leave. They did not. That was one of the elements I think that the court should look at and under the Sprotsky.
I mean, that's how you determine whether you're in custody.
They never advised, looked at another way. They never advised him that he could leave at any time. They never advised him that he could refuse to answer questions.
It's his own home. You don't tell somebody you're free to leave your own home if you want. We'll stay behind.
That is true.
It wouldn't be a very sensible thing to tell him.
No, it wouldn't, but it would at least advise him that he didn't have to have them or entertain them in his home at the time.
Is there anything that, on which you're relying that was not equally true in the Beckwith case?
Well, I think I'm not familiar with the circumstances entirely of the Beckwith case.
Well, then I guess you can't tell me whether it wasn't equally true in Beckwith. I'm a little puzzled. There's only one case in which the Supreme Court has addressed the question whether questioning in one's home is custodial interrogation. It's Beckwith. And neither side mentions Beckwith. I mean, why not discuss the controlling Supreme Court precedent?
My understanding of the case that I relied on was a Schneckel case, Schneckel versus Bustamante.
And Schneckloff against Bustamante has nothing to do with Miranda.
But it does set
Beckwith
forth.
Beckwith does.
It sets forth the criteria, I believe, that the court should look at
to
determine.
Schneckloff is a Fourth Amendment case. Miranda is about the Fifth Amendment. They are really completely unrelated. Indeed, the whole point of Miranda is that it differs from the voluntariness question that's used for Fourth Amendment consents, and indeed it amounts to a rejection of that criteria. And Schneckloff explained why they were different and why Miranda warnings weren't needed for a consent to search. The dominant case that bears on what's now before us today is Beckwith, as I say, and neither side seems to be aware of it.
Your Honor,
for what it's worth, I can't see anything that you're saying that wasn't said by Beckwith. Now, maybe there's something I'm missing, but if you're unfamiliar with Beckwith, won't be able to help me on that point.
I'm sorry, I can't at this time, Your Honor. I do believe, though, that the Schneckloff case does address circumstances.
Schneckloff has nothing to do with Miranda.
Well, I'm not pinpointing it to Miranda. I'm pinpointing it to the circumstances, the psychological circumstances under which a defendant can feel that he is not free not to answer the questions of the police. And that was really the reason that it was cited in my brief. It didn't go specifically to the Fifth Amendment issue or to the issue regarding the Miranda rights. In any event, during the course of the interrogation of Mr. Franklin, he began to sweat profusely. His mother described him as looking extremely nervous at the time, and he continued to ask the police officers whether or not he was under arrest. Now, he did that probably, to my recollection, at least 3 to 4 times, and although they
each
did...
Each time they told him no.
And they did tell him no. However, part of the reasoning behind the police telling him that, number one, I don't think that the officers had an intention of arresting him at that particular moment. But unquestionably, they were there to get information regarding the guns that Mr. Franklin had purchased. And also, I think they led him to believe that he had not done anything wrong, in that they kept telling him that, well, did you shoot anyone with these guns? Did you rob a bank with these guns? Did you commit a crime with these guns? And he answered no to those questions. So they led him to believe that he, in effect, hadn't done anything wrong. But they didn't really... pronounce themselves completely in terms of the circumstances of the offense for which he was eventually arrested. And I think that they knew very clearly what they were doing and what they wanted to accomplish at the time that they came to his house They had Miranda warnings with them. They could have easily had given it to him. They could have easily told him that you don't have to answer our questions, and they didn't do any of the above. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pigeon. Mr. Lang?
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Lang, and I represent the United States here today. The District Court was both reasonable and correct in determining that the defendant was not in custody for Miranda purposes when he was questioned at his home, and that the defendant's statement was voluntary. The record supports the District Court's findings that a reasonable person in the defendant's position should not have felt, would not have felt, that he was in police custody or that his freedom was deprived in any significant way. And the Court further went on to find during the course of this that the defendant actually knew and decided to cooperate, that he knew, though not advised by the agents, that he knew he had a right not to speak if he so chose. And the second issue, Your Honor, was that the defendant voluntarily decided to answer the officers.
Do you think there's any material difference between what happened here and what happened in Beckwith?
I apologize to the Court up front, Your Honor. I am not conversant in the facts in Beckwith.
But that won't happen again. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. And the second issue, Your Honor, is that the defendant...
There's only one Supreme Court case dealing with whether interrogation in one's home is custodial for purposes of Miranda. And that case is Beckwith.
Yes, Your Honor. Again, I apologize, Judge. The District Court found that the actions of the officers throughout were appropriate in terms of their approach to the house, the unannounced visit, going into the kitchen. They were invited in by the mother, and found that the defendant consented to talk to the officers, and that the defendant knew that he could refuse to speak to them. The officers didn't raise their voices. They didn't gesticulate. They didn't point. They didn't play games. And they made it quite clear that he was not going to jail. There was some discussion about any underlying offense that a recovered firearm may have been involved in, and when the defendant had concern about that, they dispelled his concerns.
Were all three in plain clothes?
Yes, sir. Two officers were seated, and then the agents, the ATF agents, and one was standing. The mother was also in the kitchen, sir, during part of this, and kind of trying to stay out of her way. The kitchen was approximately 10 by 10, but they didn't want to interfere with what the mother was doing. Mrs. Franklin was in and out of the kitchen.
Frying eggs, I suppose.
Sir?
I said cooking, I suppose. Washing dishes. Some other splendid chore.
The defendant testified, Your Honor, and the judge took special note and noted that the defendant was sophisticated and he was an individual whose will would not easily be overborne by the authorities. Your Honors, for the reasons I have stated, I respectfully ask that the ruling of the District Court be upheld and that the conviction and sentencing of the defendant be affirmed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lyon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Pigeon, does he have anything further?
If I may, I would just like to add one or two points. And Mr. Franklin did testify in the case, and he also he testified that the police officers or the agents told him that they would not, that they could not leave until he told them the truth, and also that if he didn't tell them the truth, that he would be taken to jail. So he had a continual fear, which is reflected in the record of him constantly asking the agents whether or not he was going to that he was going to go to jail, and he said he was afraid of going to jail.
Were those facts you just recited contradicted by the police?
I think at least I think at least one of them was, and the judge Judge Holderman didn't make a specific credibility finding.
Well, yes, he
just
he
found
did.
More generically that there was not a custodial setting.
Well, if there wasn't a custodial thing, he did find that they found the testimony of the police officers to be convincing.
He didn't say that Mr. Franklin was unconvincing, and it very well might...
Well, if they're telling contrary stories, and one's telling a different story than the other, when you find one convincing, the other must be not convincing, right? You can't have a tie.
Well, I think that they both could be convincing in a certain way.
Didn't Martinovich expressly deny that Franklin had been told that he'd be jailed if he didn't tell the truth?
He did say that, but he certainly admitted that Franklin kept asking over and over again whether I'm under arrest.
Yeah, and he was told no.
Yeah. And he did tell him no.
And that's agreed.
And that is agreed, correct.
But the part that we're talking about that you just raised is an issue we should look at as one with the credibility determination and the district court has already been made. What do we do with that?
Well, if the district court, firstly, the district court didn't specifically say I disbelieve.
Yes, it did. No, it doesn't have to say no. I disbelieve. I believe this one, and this one said that wasn't said.
No. Well, at the sentencing, if he had said something that was materially inaccurate, he could have received an obstruction of justice.
But he didn't, so he got lucky.
Or the judge believed what he said and still thought that it was not a custodial setting.
That's too tenuous.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. All right, next case for argument is Walker v.